Blog Talk Radio.
This is a program for all America.
Welcome aboard. It is the Amy Beth Arkwe Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. Hope you had a great week. We're inching towards the weekend. Number, by the way, if you're listening live on Friday, is up and running at 347-857-4505. You can also tweet us live during the show at AB Writes. Some interesting things to talk about today, the free flow pop culture convo as time permits. Also, a doozy from the mailbag I will share with you, and some must-sees for the weekend moviegoers. First, though, I'd like you to meet our guests. You know, I often ask my clients as a creativity coach and counselor, what did you want to be when you grew up, when you were a kid? And I don't think anybody has ever answered paranormal researcher, but it's a fascinating endeavor, and our guest, Sylvia Schultz, is just that, a paranormal investigator and author of an interesting new book called Fractured Spirits, Hauntings at the Peoria State Hospital. Sylvia, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm sure this is a question everybody asks you. How the heck did you get into this? Were you attracted to ghost stories as a kid?
Oh, man, I ate up ghost stories when I was a little kid. You could always suck me in with a good ghost story, whether it was around the campfire or babysitting. I'd go through the people's shelves, try to find books on ghost stories. Yeah, I didn't grow up in a haunted house. I didn't have any paranormal experiences whatsoever until I started, until I became a researcher and started exposing my consciousness to this. But, I always loved ghost stories.
So you were just attracted. Was it the scary part of it or the unknown? What about it was gripping to you as a kid?
Well, the scary part got me for sure. But also the fact that it was the history part of it, too. And the thought that, you know, the stories, the people that these stories were about lived, you know, just the same as I do, but, you know, years ago, centuries ago. And I just found it interesting that people had the same lives, basically, that we do. I mean, they may not have had iPhones and CDs and whatnot, but they enjoyed the same things that we do today.
And some of them enjoyed it so much they're still hanging around, or maybe not. That's always the interesting story, is why they're hanging around. But so how did you get into, from the love of ghost stories as a kid, to actually going out and becoming a paranormal researcher? I mean, what's the training for this? I'm not even aware of how this works.
I've been a writer for a very long time, and I was contacted by a publisher just out of the thin blue sky, and he asked me to write a book called Ghosts of the Illinois River. This fellow did a series of ghost story books, Ghosts of the I&M Canal, Ghosts of Route 66, Ghosts of I-80, and he called me up. Still have no idea how he found me. And he said, I would like you to write a book called Ghosts of the Illinois River. And I said, oh, wow, this is perfect. I live right next to the Illinois River. So that was a really big treat for me, having adored ghost stories all my life, to be able to write a book on them myself. I mean, I was just thrilled to bits to be able to do this. So in preparation for doing that, I looked up some historical stories, and whenever anyone asked me what project I was working on, I'd say a book of true ghost stories, and they'd say, oh, I've got a story to share with you. So I collected some stories that way. And I also reached out to local investigators, local paranormal investigators. I was doing some research on the Peoria Players Theater. They have a resident ghost who is just a bunch of fun. His name is Norman. And there was a director at the theater in the 1960s, late 1950s, early 1960s. I think he passed away in 1960. And he just loved it so much that, again, he never left. But there was a paranormal investigation group that was going to do an investigation at the theater. And I met them. I heard about this and met them at the theater. And there's some reason we couldn't get in that night. I think there had been a break in at the theater, so the manager didn't want anyone in there after a while, so we ended up just going home that night. But I got to do some investigations with them, and through them I met some more groups. And that's the neat thing about being an author as well, is that I get to play with any group that will have me. I don't have to belong to a certain group. I'll just say, hey, can I tag along on your investigation? And most of the time, I mean, 99% of the time, people will let me tag along, which is really fun.
Sure. So you kind of learned as you went. So your training is as a writer, you kind of learned and shadowed these people who did this as a profession or an avocation.
Exactly.
It's really,
Yeah, exactly. I don't know anyone who does it full-time, but, well, no, Troy Taylor does it full-time. But I've never, I would love to be able to go on an investigation with Troy Taylor one time, but I haven't, the opportunity hasn't arisen yet. But yeah, I get to play with all sorts of fun toys and meet a bunch of interesting people, and it's a lot of fun.
So this first, that book about the Illinois River led you to this. Now, the Peoria State Hospital also sounds like a fascinating place, and you do say that there's been a couple of books written about it, but this one is a collection, really, of the ghost stories, right? Is that what it is?
Yes, exactly so. I was chatting with a bookstore manager in Peoria, and she and I got to talking about the asylum because I mentioned I was doing a library program at the Alpha Park Library, which is in Bartonville, which is where the asylum is. And she said, oh, yeah, you're going to the asylum? And I said, well, I don't know. This was long before I had any interest in it at all. And she said, yeah, there have been two books written on the history of the place. And she said, we can't keep these on the shelves at the bookstore. We order them 100 at a time, and they just fly off the shelves because people are so interested in the place. And I knew from my ghost story reading that any book about haunted Illinois is going to mention Bartonville as being a very, very haunted place. And she said, this manager said, I don't think anyone has ever gone around and collected all of these stories that people have been telling for 40 years and more. I said, you know
what?
Light
bulb moment.
Oh, yeah. she said, you should write that book. I said, okay, gosh darn it, I will. And it's been a really fun journey because what I discovered is that, yes, it's haunted to the rafters, but it's also a great resource of history. And that the history behind this asylum is absolutely astounding. When you say haunted asylum, you automatically think abuse. You think patients being chained up. You think horrible, horrible things. But that could not be further from the truth at the Peoria State Hospital. This is a place of caring and compassion. The superintendent that started off at the hospital when it opened in 1902, Dr. George Zeller, he was light years ahead of his time when it came to the treatment of the mentally ill. He took all the bars off of the windows, and he took the chains out. He forbade the use of manacles and straitjackets. He put these all in a small room off of his office, and he used that to point to and say, never again, not here, not at this institution.
So people always envision like the snake pit or that American Horror Story where they did the asylum, where it's a horrible place, but you're really saying that this was a place that was beneficial to the patients, that took good, loving care of them at a time when it really wasn't happening all that often. I mean, some places still isn't happening. Yeah. So they're not, it's haunted because people want to stay there, but you also, it's some natural, well, you'll go into it a little bit more with us, the natural phenomenon that you call the perfect storm that created why the spirits are so active there. But go ahead, finish. I'm
exactly.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just sort of moving you along a little bit, but I don't want to totally interrupt you.
That's fine.
When people think about the haunting or being haunted, you think that people are upset. They're haunting it because they're angry, but it really makes sense that they would want to be there if they really enjoyed their stay there. And that's kind of what you're saying, that they liked it there.
Absolutely.
It was a lovely place. Yeah.
Absolutely. They were well cared for. There were There were movies every Friday night. There were dances every Saturday night. All of the patients had the opportunity to go to church on Sunday, services on Sunday. During nice weather, there were baseball games after church on Sunday afternoons. These were people that were very well cared for. And Dr. Zeller realized that it wasn't a good idea to just build a massive big building and throw everybody into one area. He insisted that the asylum be built on something called a cottage system, where there were different cottages for different afflictions. And I say cottage, and what I really actually mean is McMansion, because these places were huge. So epileptics were housed with epileptics. So if somebody started having a fit, they had a buddy system going on, where you had support that was just as close as your buddy. He was the first to recognize post-traumatic stress disorder. He realized that soldiers coming home from World War I were having difficulty reintegrating into society and needed a safe place. He recognized postpartum stress disorder. I mean, there was a cottage specifically built for women who were suffering from this unknown disorder that happened after they gave birth and just didn't know how to care for their children or were unable to care for their children. It was just a really astounding place.
Now, why did it, now it closed in the early 70s? Is that right? Now, why do you know why it closed?
I do, and it's a very, very sad story. I've been spending the past several minutes talking about how wonderful a place it was. During the mid-1960s, there was a great deal of renovation going on at the Peoria State Hospital. And in order to get funds for this renovation, the Peoria State Hospital, of course, went to the state of Illinois to get these funds. And that caused the state to take a good hard look at the hospital. And what they found was that the Peoria State Hospital was the number one institution in the country for curing their patients. They had the highest rate of cure. Unfortunately, it was also the most expensive to run. So the state started cutting funding. So you had one nurse for every four patients, and then it went down to one nurse for every 10 patients, one nurse for every 20 patients, and it
went
quickly downhill.
They sabotaged their own good work, is what you're saying. Yeah.
Exactly so, yes. And with this reduction in staff, and with this need to get a staff that would work for a cheaper wage, the hospital had to start cutting corners, and that's when abuse started creeping in. They hired younger attendants that didn't have the experience. They hired doctors that were, they're called limited practice doctors. They were doctors maybe from the Philippines who didn't have enough English to pass a regular medical board, but passed just enough so that they could work in a mental hospital. So you had
where you really need to have as much communication skills as possible. That might help, right?
For real, yeah.
So he
had all these cost-cutting measures and the reductions in staff, and the staff were just panicking over this. They said, you know, this is our reputation on the line. Please, please, please don't. And the state eventually decided to close the hospital, and they did in 1973. And the staff went to Springfield and picketed. They went to the Capitol and just picketed and said, please, please, don't turn our patients out with nowhere to go. We want.
Where do they turn these? Where were these people? This was the time when throughout the country, a lot of hospitals were closing down. They just sort of put people out on the streets, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that didn't happen with the Peoria State Hospital. By the time it closed in 1973, in the late fall of 1973, there were 17 patients left. They were mostly geriatric. They got sent to places like Springfield, the Galesburg Mental Health Center. There was a nursing home in Pekin, where I live, that took a couple of them. And the really heartbreaking story about this is that, okay, Springfield is like an hour and a half away from Bartonville, where the asylum is. There are police reports of patients walking back from Springfield all the way to Bartonville and being found sitting on the steps of their cottage that used to be their home, saying, please let me in. What did I do wrong? Please let me in. And it's just absolutely deplorable the way they let these people down. So,
well, what happened? Yeah. So the buildings were there, and you described the buildings, as you said, there's a lot of, you know, it's a pretty grand place physically. What happened? Mm-hmm. Now, they tried to sell it, I think, at one point, and they couldn't sell it. Tell us a little bit about
exactly
that.
Exactly so, yes. The village of Bartonville tried very hard to sell these cottages, but they were far too large for a single-family home. But they were really kind of a little small and not really suitable for any sort of industrial use. There's one cottage that's still left that's a dentist's office. I know that much. But most of these cottages ended up being knocked down. And when I say knocked down, that's exactly what I mean. I took a wrecking ball and just knocked the entire cottage into the basement. And then whatever rubble was left over on top, they scooped it up in dumpsters. And they dumped it into the ravines that kind of crisscrossed the hilltop there. And that, coming full circle, is one of the many reasons that this entire hilltop is so haunted. Because even after 40 years, there are still artifacts in these ravines. There are places in the ravines where you can't take two steps without stepping on broken crockery. It's still all down there. All the patients' belongings are still down there. People are still finding. I talked to somebody who found a rouge pot with some powder still in it and the little powder puff still in it. And it's still all there. And if you go poking around in the ravines, you can. And if you have a recorder running, you can sometimes catch EVPs of people talking about you poking around their stuff.
Oh, it's interesting. Well, talk a little bit about the ghost box, the different equipment that you use to actually get some of these sounds, because that's fascinating, too. Now, you're skeptical about some of your equipment, or you were. Tell us a little bit about that.
I was. I have always been the kind of person to say, you know what, I got to see it for myself. I got to hear it for myself. But at the same time, as an author, I really have to believe everything people tell me, all these stories people tell me, because if I'm not invested in it, then I can't expect my readers to be invested in it. So I'm very conflicted that way.
You want to believe the story, but you want to go out and prove it. Yeah, I get it.
Right, yeah, I want to prove it. I want to be able to have something to show to other people to say, look, this is what we captured. What do you think of this? There's a nifty piece of equipment called a ghost box or a spirit box or a Frank's box. There are all sorts of different names. What it is basically you take an AM radio and there's a wire that you snip so that it scrolls through the dial and it just puts out a lot of white noise, and little blips of sound every once in a while, little blips of words. And the theory is that the spirits that are around can use this energy and this white noise and these little snippets of words to form words. And it's fascinating when you get on a roll with one of these spirit boxes, because you can have what appears to be a real-time conversation with these spirits that are hanging around. And it's fascinating because they make words that are answers to the questions that you're asking. It's just astounding.
I don't know
how it works, but it's cool.
It's sort of like an audio Ouija board or something, right? God, that's fascinating.
You know what? That's a really good way to describe it, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you ask a question, and sometimes, by gosh, you actually get answers. It's
like
wild.
They're intermingling with some old, it sounds like it's intermingling with like old radio shows, though, old radio hosts. Maybe one of my old shows are in there. I don't know.
It could be. You never know what's floating around out there in the ether.
Well, they always say it takes a while to go there, so your old shows are out there in the universe somewhere. They're listening many, many years later.
Get it out there, the universe.
So you've experimented with this, right? Have you encountered some interesting, what are some of the strangest stories or things that you could piece together, conversations that you overheard? And can you communicate with them or no? It's just that you're overhearing them, having their conversation.
No, you have a conversation with them.
You
if
have
you're
an
lucky,
conversation.
They will actually interact and have an actual conversation. It's wonderful. I've had
Give me an example.
Of experiences. Yeah. I was, most of these occurrences happen in the morgue area of the Pollock Hospital, which is the old TB ward. There were 63 buildings on the hilltop at its height. 13 of those buildings are left. Two of those buildings are still devoted to being open for investigation, for paranormal investigation. One of those is the Bowen Building, which is the administration building, and about a block and a half away is the Pollock Hospital, which is the old TB ward. And the basement of the Pollock Hospital is a very, very active place. There are two rooms in the basement. One was used for storage, and the other farther room was used as the morgue. And if you stand on a concrete floor in the morgue, you're actually standing on about 3 feet of natural spring.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so you've got the running water there, which just amplifies things. So I was with a group called Peoria Paranormal. We were in the storage room of the basement of the Pollock, and we were working with a ghost box. And it was a real eye-opening experience because there are several entities down in the basement of the Pollock building. And one of them is a great big bully of a spirit who he likes to hurt people. He'll stand behind them and just kind of push on the muscles of their necks and just cause real stiff necks and neck pain just because he can. And he has a particular dislike for one of the male investigators of Peoria Paranormal. So if Derek goes down in the basement of the Pollock building with a ghost box, you can be sure that this entity is going to show up and just start cussing him out.
Wow.
And that's something else. I mean, you hear some very strange things coming from this ghost box that you should not be hearing on AM radio. These are words that do not appear on AM radio, so that's how you know it's something else speaking. It's not just
random.
Oh, I see.
The FCC would not approve of these words. I get you.
Precisely, yes. That's what I was trying to get at. So I knew I couldn't see them either. So anyway, we're standing around. The ghost box is on the floor, and I was standing there with about eight of us standing around this ghost box having a conversation, and I was standing there with my recorder in one hand, and my other hand, my left hand, was just sort of at my side. I wasn't really paying much attention to it. And I realized about halfway through this conversation that we were having that the fingers of my left hand were starting to get warm. Oh, wow, that's kind of weird. It's April, so my fingers should really kind of be chilly down here in the basement of an unheated building, but they're really, really getting warm. And after a while, it was as though I was holding my fingers to the gently glowing coals of a campfire. It was that noticeable.
Wow.
So I said, look, there's something going on here. And that's what you do when something weird happens. You tell the other investigators about it so they can help you figure out what's going on. So we had a medium with us. And I said, come over here to this side of the group and tell me what's going on. And she concentrated for a while, and she said, yes, there's somebody holding your hand. And she looked at me and she said, Sylvia, you have a fan. And just then the ghost box yelped, yes.
Wow. How fascinating. Was it this guy that didn't like the other guy?
It was no, it was somebody else entirely. We asked the spirit his name. He says, who's holding Sylvia's hand? And the ghost box said, Christopher. And he just held my hand for a good 5 minutes or so. And then the feeling started to fade. The warmth started to fade. And there was somebody, an investigator, standing behind me. And he said, well, all this guy really wants is to be in the book. And the medium concentrated for a little bit. And she said, actually, that's exactly what he wants.
So did you find out more about Christopher and what his story was?
Actually, I did. I did find out more about him, not about his history or his story. That was in April, and I returned to the Pollock building in July of that year with a different medium, a very powerful medium. And she and I and another friend went down into the basement, and I told her the story of Christopher holding my hand. And she said, actually, he's here now. He's here again. And I held out my hand, and I didn't feel the warmth anymore. I just sort of felt kind of a tingling in my palm as though he was trying to hold my hand but couldn't quite manage it. And this medium said, Christopher is a tall young man, late 20s or so, very good looking, which I was happy to hear. And
Yeah.
She said, he loves you. Not in a romantic way, but you remind him of somebody he knew in life. That's all she was able to tell me. But I said, oh, wow, what a wonderful thing to be able to do, to come down here and interact with these spirits who are probably kind of lonely by now, and to remind someone of someone that they knew so powerfully that they come over and hold your hand for a while and try to talk to you. That's really neat.
Yeah, that is very neat. Exactly.
Yeah.
But what do they do with them? So, like you said, I mean, do they come and go, or they're stuck here? Because I envision that, you know, they always say sometimes that people are, when they're not going to the next realm, it's because they have unfinished business. Are they just going to stay here until at some point they decide to move on to the next realm, or do they come and go? I mean, how does that work? Do you know?
Well, I had someone explain it to me just about a week ago. He said that ghosts are entities that are stuck here on this plane, the ones that have unfinished business, the ones that are suffering through a loop or something, some sort of, if they died violently and don't realize that they're dead yet, or if they died violently and have a compulsion to keep repeating it, that would be what we call a ghost. Now, spirits are something a little bit different. Spirits have crossed over, but they can come and go. They have enjoyed their life so much here that, yeah, they return to the scenes of where they were most comfortable, where they were happiest. I have a friend who works at the Pollock Hospital that is very interested in the history of the place, and she'll give cemetery tours and tours of the building. She was doing a cemetery tour when someone asked her, why is this place so haunted? And they had a recorder going, which is the only reason they caught this, but I'm absolutely delighted that they did. Chris was about to give her answer, which is, well, why are most haunted houses haunted? It's the place where they felt comfortable. It's the place where they felt happy and loved. That's the place they returned to. So this fellow asked, why is this place so haunted? And before Chris could even draw a breath to answer, they caught a child's voice on the recorder in the middle of the cemetery saying, they're just so nice here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. So I understand that they have, like you said, they have tours. They also, did I read this correctly, that they have overnight tours? I mean, where do the people stay then if you want to go to overnight? If there's a place to sleep, or you just stay outside, or what's the...
No, you just stay up all night hunting ghosts. I should clarify that. With the Bowen Building, there are overnights. There are campouts. They call them creepy campouts. And you are actually invited to pitch a tent on the big front lawn. The Bowen Building is very iconic in many people's minds in this area, because when people would go to visit their loved ones in the asylum on a Sunday afternoon, if the weather was nice, the patients would be brought out to meet with their loved ones on the front lawn of the Bowen Building. If a patient was geriatric and couldn't be moved, you'd go to their room. But other than that, the patient would be brought out to visit with their family. So the Bowen Building has this great, big, smooth, beautiful front lawn. And that's where people are allowed to pitch the tent for overnights. And they can run around all around the outside of the building. They can run around in the cemeteries, take whatever pictures, do whatever recording they want to. With the Pollock Hospital, it's a bit different. You are allowed the full range of the building from 6 in the evening till 6 o'clock in the morning. And you have access to all the cemeteries as well. And the Bowen does overnight. The administration building does do overnight visits as well. And again, you can stay up all night if you want to, or, you know, sleep in a tent, see if somebody scratches on your tent in the middle of the night, which I've heard of happening.
Creepy campouts, indeed. Now, this is a popular attraction. They obviously have it set up, so I'm guessing a lot of people do that. Yeah.
Yes, the creepy campouts are very, very popular. I got a lot of my stories for the book by going to these creepy campouts and just listening to the tales people had to tell.
What's your before we let you leave? Give me what's your favorite story? Do you have one that's your favorite or scare or most haunting?
Oh, well, one of my all-time favorites has to do with the Pollock Building. I have a friend, a business partner, actually, who is sensitive. He can see spirits when his radar is up, we'll say. And he came to visit me. He lives about an hour and a half away from me, and he came to visit me to do some library visits to drop off books that our publishing company had put out. So I gave him directions to several area libraries, and he was going to do library visits and then meet me for lunch. So he's on his way up the hill in Bartonville, passing the asylum, and I get a text from him, and he says, "Was there a TB ward attached to this asylum you keep talking about?" I said, "Yes, it was called the Pollock Building." And he goes, "Oh, that's what I thought. I picked up a hitchhiker." And over lunch, he told me the entire story. He was driving up the hill, and he was driving a pickup truck, and he became aware of somebody sitting in his passenger seat. And he looked over, and he said it was this guy who, he looked like a farmer. He had big calloused hands, and he was dressed in kind of worn but serviceable clothes. And he looked like he'd been a big guy but had gotten sick later in life. And David
said... He actually saw him, though.
He saw him
actually saw him. And David started getting a tightness in his chest. And he's like, "Oh, I wonder if this is TV." So he spoke to the spirit next to him. And he said, "Hello, my name's David. What's your name?" And the spirit said, "George." And David said, well, "George, what's wrong?" And George said, "Well, I have TB." And David said, "Okay, you're not planning on coming home with me, are you?" And George said, no, this is my home." And David said, "Okay, well, then what are you doing in my truck?" And George said, "Well, I don't get out much."
That's a riot.
But it's interesting that he appealed to him as a person. I mean, you don't normally see the actual physical being, do you?
Right. So he was just messing around with all sorts of stuff, and he was absolutely fascinated with the dashboard of David's truck. He was like, "So where's the gear shift?" And David had to explain to him that, no, it doesn't have a gear shift. It's an automatic. And George said, "Wow, boy, I bet that really helps you get up the hill, huh?" He had to explain automatic transmissions to this guy. And he was, like, playing with the radio. He's like, "Oh, this is so neat." So he went to the different library with David, and David got out, and so did George, and followed him into the library. And he's racing around, looking at all the computers and stuff, and this ghostly energy was kind of messing with the computers. And David said he felt like he was babysitting a 3-year-old because he kept saying, "George, just get away from the computer. You're gonna break it."
So the whole time that this is going on, though, David could see George, but nobody else could see George. Is this what you're trying to tell me?
Yes, exactly. Okay. And he felt kind of weird because he was talking to the librarian, who was very, very busy at that time, and he was also trying to look over his shoulder to make sure he didn't leave George behind in the library when he left. So he got done with his visit, and he said, "All right," he's trying not to be obvious about it or anything. People think he's nuts. He said, "All right, George, time to go." So George got back in the truck with him and rode with him all the way down the hillside, down the road. And about at the level of the Pollock Hospital, which was where he started out, he said, "Well, thanks for putting up with me," and vanished.
So funny. But isn't that unusual? Is it unusual to actually see the physical being, or no?
You have to have the talent to do that. I never thought I did. I would always complain, "Oh, man, I never get touched. I never see anything," because I hadn't for a very long time. And then I was again with Peoria Paranormal, and we were in the basement of the Pollock building, and there was a group already down there, so we said, well, we'll take our group upstairs and do something else for a while, let this group investigate down here in the morgue. So we were on our way up the stairs, and I didn't know most of the people in the group. It's one of these groups that I just tagged along with for the evening. So I really don't like being the last person out of a dark room that I know is haunted. So I made sure that there was somebody yeah. behind me. And I could see her very clearly. It was a girl about my height with long, straight, blonde hair, and she was wearing like this blue puffy ski jacket. I thought she was another investigator. So we go up the stairs. This whole group troops up the stairs, and there's a big, heavy door at the top of the stairs, this metal door. So I stopped, and I held the door for the girl that I was convinced was behind me. I was the last one.
Wasn't there. This is fascinating. This is really fascinating. It's creepy, but it's so fascinating because most of the people that you've encountered, most of the spirits you've encountered, have been positive. They haven't been negative, so that you could be haunted and not. People think haunting is like, you know, it's got to be horrible, like Amityville Horror, but it's not always that way.
Most of the spirits I've encountered at the Peoria State Hospital are pleasant, they're funny, and they're just a real pleasure to be around.
It's a very cool concept, cool book. It's called Fractured Spirits, Hauntings at the Peoria State Hospital. Sylvia Schultz, you can go to her website, sylviaschultz.com. Also, we should mention on Facebook, you have a fascinating Facebook page. Just put in Fractured Spirits, the book, and it will come up. You'll have some interactive things for people to go to, video snippets, audio, other things, so you can sort of, as you're reading the book, play along, so to speak, and get a more personal viewpoint. So it's fascinating. It's a fascinating read and a fascinating endeavor. Are you doing another one? Are you hooked on this? So you're going to do some more paranormal investigations?
I am absolutely hooked. I have a couple more books in the works, and you can be sure that at least one of them is going to be about the Peoria State Hospital. There's a local filmmaker who has done a couple of films on patients at the hospital, historical patients, and he asked me to write a companion book to one of his feature-length films about a patient named Rhoda Derry. Her story is fascinating. Her story can be found in Fractured Spirits.
Okay, very cool. You've got some very interesting stories, interesting endeavor, that's for sure. Sylvia Schultz, a pleasure talking with you. I wish you the best. I hope you and your spirits come back and see us again, okay?
Thank you, Amy. I appreciate being on.
Thank you. It was fun. It is the Amy Beth Arkley Show, 347-857-4505. We'll scare up a little pop culture convo, and I've got a couple of haunting treats for Richard Nixon fans, you know who you are, and Anthony Weiner fans, too. I don't know who you are. That's all coming up on the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Stick around.
Touch that dial. We'll be right back after these brief words from our sponsors.
Sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't. I'm in that nut, mounds don't. I'm in got real milk chocolate, coconut and munchy nuts too. Mounds got deep dark chocolate and chewy coconut. Sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't. Beautiful.
Chock full of nuts in that heavenly coffee, heavenly coffee, heavenly coffee. Chock full of
politics that if we buckle down, we can always fight when we know we're right, and we know we're right, so buckle down. Make 'em yell for Nixon, make 'em yell. We can win with Nixon if we make 'em yell. If we don't give in, take it on the chin. We can win with Nixon if we'll only knuckle down. He has been to 50 lands across the sea, and they know he stands for peace and liberty. He has friends everywhere, over here, over there. What a president he'll make for you and me. Buckle down with Nixon, buckle down. We can win with Nixon if we buckle down. He has set the pace, we will win the race. Yes, we'll win the race with a Nixon victory.
Uh-huh. That was back in 1968, I think, the Nixon campaign song. Welcome back. It's the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show here on VTR. 347-857-4505 gets you into the mix. Play that song because yesterday, 39 years ago yesterday, August 8th, was an infamous anniversary for Richard Nixon and the country. More on that. Here's Bill Curtis.
Richard M. Nixon's career seemed to thrive on paradox. He was a man famous for his lack of personal grace. Yet he became the only candidate in U.S. history who was twice elected both president and vice president. In the moments of his greatest triumph, he planted the seeds of future self-destruction, while his most public failures only seemed to gird his determination to mount ever more astonishing comebacks. In November 1972, Nixon was re-elected president in a landslide, carrying 49 of 50 states. But in the midst of that election campaign, Nixon's paranoia and distrust led to his downfall. Determined not to be blindsided by political dirty tricks, he planted one of his own, authorizing a burglary attempt of the Democratic Party headquarters at Washington's Watergate Hotel. The intruders were caught, setting into motion a White House cover-up, which would take 2 years to unravel. Yet unravel it did, leading to televised Senate hearings with all the drama of a daily soap opera. By the summer of 1974, many of Nixon's top aides had resigned and were under legal indictment. Finally, a tape recording system Nixon had installed in the White House provided evidence that the president had been involved in the cover-up all along.
This is an NBC News hotline report. This is Steve Porter. The rapidly unfolding events in Washington point to the resignation of President Richard Nixon today. An announcement was made at the White House a short time ago, and on the line with me to discuss that is NBC News White House correspondent Russ Ward in Washington.
Yes, Steve, there's no doubt in anyone's mind now that the resignation announcement will be forthcoming tonight. We were informed at 11 o'clock this morning, Eastern Time, that the president had called the vice president into his Oval Office for a private meeting. That private meeting lasted an hour and 10 minutes. A short time later, Press Secretary Ronald Ziegler came into the briefing room and had this announcement.
Tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, the President of the United States will address the nation on radio and television from his Oval Office.
Facing near certain impeachment, Nixon spoke on television to the American people on August 8, 1974, and announced that he would become the first president in U.S. history to resign from that office.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress. Particularly at this time, with problems we face at home and abroad, to continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the President and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
1 month later, Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford, closed the Watergate saga by granting Nixon a presidential pardon.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have come to a decision which I felt I should tell you and all of my fellow American citizens. As soon as I was certain in my own mind and in my own conscience that it is the right thing to do. There are no historic or legal precedents to which I can turn in this matter. None that precisely fit the circumstances of a private citizen who has resigned the presidency of the United States. Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
For several years after that, Nixon slipped from view, and many observers assumed that his public career had ended at last. And yet, slowly but surely, he came back once more. In 1993, he returned to the House of Representatives and began his speech by humorously echoing General Douglas MacArthur's famous farewell. "Old politicians may die," he told the assembled congressman, "but they never fade away."
Indeed, Richard Nixon resigning 39 years ago yesterday. And I remember as a little kid watching on TV, you know, your memories when you're a kid, it's like a sort of gauzy view. And, of course, TV was different then. We were like three or five stations. You had to get up and actually change the station. But, wow, what a moment in history. And really, when you think about the story and the premise of this show, of course, everyone has a story. And, boy, Richard Nixon had a doozy, didn't he? Is his own paranoia. I mean, he won by a landslide, so they didn't need the whole Watergate affair, number one. And number two, he taped every darn thing, those 18 missing minutes. So all his potty mouth and all his paranoia and all his anger and anti-Semitism, racism, all that kind of stuff came spilling out. We would never have known this if he didn't voluntarily tape all this stuff. So it's just crazy what paranoia will do to you. And there's a few minutes left here on the Amy Beth Arkley Show. 347-857-4505 gets you in the mix. Wanted to say, Joy Behar left The View today after 16 years. What a class act. Funny lady. I know she was pushed down, but went along with the gag and graciously left, unlike one of her predecessors, Star Jones, who insisted on saying she was fired. I'm not sure why they gave her the boot. I guess her Q ratings or whatever they decided went down, or they thought she was too old. Barbara's hanging in for another year, and she's much older, but she was interesting. She had an acerbic wit from time to time, but certainly a nice personality, and I think we'll miss Joy. Not that I watch The View on a regular basis, but she's one of the few people that I enjoyed watching, she and Whoopi. So if Whoopi leaves, that's it for me, I guess. But Jenny McCarthy's coming in, and she can be funny. So she may do a nice job, and we'll see who, if anyone, replaces Elizabeth Hasselbeck, who originally moved over to Fox where she belongs and where she always wanted to be. So wish her the best, Joy. Hope you reemerge somewhere. I'm sure you will. I know she got tossed off of Current TV as well. She had a show there for a while, although I never saw it because who the heck gets Current TV? Although we do get the Blaze Network. Have you seen that one? Glenn Beck's mockery of a network, and that screwy channel, and those people are crazy, especially Glenn Beck. So who knows? Current TV taken over by Al Jazeera, so now we'll probably get it. It won't have anything good, but we wish you the best, Joy. And this weekend, a couple of must-sees in the movie theater. I want you to go see Fruitvale Station if you get a chance. It's a very interesting indie movie, a heart-wrencher, really, but so well done. It's fast-paced, but you get so much in that time frame. It's a star turn for Michael B. Jordan, not the basketball player, but the actor who's been around for a while, I believe. But this one is his moment to really shine. He plays the real-life character Oscar Grant, who tragically was killed by police in 2009 on New Year's Eve. In a police melee, a minor police melee on the subway. It was a big commotion. One of the police officers wound up serving, I think, 6 or 11 months in prison. for involuntary manslaughter. He claims he thought he was shooting off his taser gun, not his actual gun, when he shot Grant, who in the movie makes clear is no angel. He was a young man, a young father, I think 22 years old at the time of his death, who had been in and out of trouble. He did serve some time for drug dealing, but was trying to get his act together, had a great family, and really a nice personality, and I think this movie kind of shows all sides of it. So it's a good little film. Go check it out. The theaters are finally catching on in the movies that not everybody wants to see the action films or kid stuff. So in August, you got a few choices. That's out there. The Butler, Lee Daniels' Butler, looks fabulous. Speaking of Richard Nixon, I think John Cusack plays Richard Nixon. It's a movie based on a true life story with Forrest Whitaker, who they're already talking Oscar for, as a man who was a butler, a real-life butler in the White House over six or seven presidents. And I think Robin Williams plays Eisenhower. I think Liv Schreiber plays Johnson. I don't know who plays Reagan. Cusack, as we said, plays Nixon. So it should be interesting to see. It's gotten some good reviews. Oprah Winfrey's back. She plays the wife. So interesting. We'll see what happens. And I'm looking forward to the Woody Allen, Blue Jasmine, which I hear they say it's as good as his best movie since Annie Hall, and it might be even as good or better. So they're already talking Oscar for that movie. Cate Blanchett, supposedly phenomenal. Sally Hawkins, Bobby Cannavale, you can't go wrong with him. And Andrew Dice Clay, surprisingly enough, makes a comeback. So we'll see. If I see that one, I'll let you know. If you see it, you let me know. On my DVD list, I'm recommending Welcome to the Rileys. I think I mentioned this movie before. It's a beautiful film starring James Gandolfini, the late soprano actor, in a wonderful indie portrayal of a heartbroken father who loses a daughter and then befriends and tries to help a prostitute. And Melissa Leo plays the wife. It's a very interesting small movie that I think didn't get a lot of attention, but now because of James Gandolfini's death is getting some. By the way, he's got his final movie, Enough Said, is a romantic comedy they're already working on the trailer for, I think, which co-stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus. So that should be interesting as well. And also Ginger and Rosa was a nice little film, indie film also featuring some interesting people in small parts, including Christina Hendricks from Mad Men fame, Annette Bening, who plays sort of a mousy anti-war protester, and Oliver Platt, a movie set in the Cold War era, early 60s in England, about two young girls who are struggling with what's happening politically as well as their personal lives and a personal betrayal. Ending leaves you a little cold, as in the Cold War, but it's still worth the watch, I think. Anyway, that's my view. Hey, by the way, if you want to get in touch with the show, please hop over to the website. It's amybetharkawi.com. Follow the show on the blog talk site, the Amy Beth Arkawi Show. You can find me on Twitter as well. At A.B. Wright, some interesting notes coming up next Friday at 1 o'clock. Lane Stone, a fellow mystery author, will be here, so I know Trudy's getting ready for that infamous Jerry Lewis song. I love a murder mystery upon the radio. She will be here to talk about her latest book in the Tierra Investigation series, Domestic Affairs, and we'll have a little special salute to the king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley. That's next Friday. Monday, it's the Free Flow Pop Culture Convo and a visit from the Tuners, an old-time old guys who are still rock and rolling. So we'll talk to them. That's all coming up on Monday. Hey, before we leave, I know Anthony Weiner's back in the news. This time he insulted a reporter. This guy he's like the gift that keeps on giving, or does he, to New York. The Capitol Steps pay homage.
I was afraid to log on to my Twitter. I was afraid of just what I would see. Just to check my account gave me jitters, 'cause my last tweet contained BVDs. One, two, twice, here on my handheld device. Yes, on my itsy-bitsy teeny screen were pictures of a guy named Weiner. He's in Congress, as plain as can be. He is not so teeny-weeny, I sure hope that's a zucchini. That's a member I don't want to see. Now the reason his colleagues can't laugh is, in D.C. they will measure you by just how large and impressive your staff is. And they can't shake a stick at this guy. 8, 9, 10, here's advice for all the men. If you are itsy-bitsy, teeny-weeny, extra-large or in-betweeny, send a photo that's sure to arouse. We wiener shots were idiotic. Women don't find that erotic. Send us one where you're cleaning the house.
That would be erotic, right? Cleaning the house. I don't know. The guy just keeps on going. Filner, too, out in San Diego, both of them refusing to give up their respective endeavors. One has a job as mayor of San Diego. The other one trying to become mayor of New York, which is not going to happen. Hey, have yourself a great weekend. Whatever you do, wherever you go, do drive safe, play nice, dream big. We'll talk next time. That's Monday on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Thanks to Trudy and Aurora in the booth and ML at headquarters from CCS. Have a great weekend.
Cities of Mexico, living in a apartment out on Avenue Way, at a tall on a corner of film. Had myself a lover who was finer than gold, but I've been broken, I've been busted or slim. Love don't play games with me anymore like she did before. That would fit in the folds in my wallet, and it stayed pretty good. Still amazed I wasn't losing all the loop of the place. When I was drunk and I was thinking of you. Every day the children, they were singing the tune down on the streets, and you could hear from inside. Used to take the subway on the house, and third I would wait, but you would not try to hide. Love won't play any games with you anymore if you don't want them to. World won't wait, watch you shame. But honey, I don't blame you. Hell, I still love you, New York. Hell, I still love you, New York. New York. I remember Christmas in the blistering cold in the church on the Upper West Side. Babe, I stood to sing and I was holding your arm. You were holding my trust like a child. Found a lot of trouble out on Avenue B, but I tried to keep it over hello. Farewell to the city and the love of my life. Yes, we lived before we had to go. Love won't play any games with you anymore if you don't want them to. Leave a sheet, so bang out the door.
Case closed.
in the